Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Jim Doyle, President of Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. Tax reform is one of the most hotly debated economic issues in Washington right now. We'd like to review the key aspects of leading proposals and talk about what Congress can do to get something done. We're thrilled to have Douglas Holtz-Eakin joining us. Douglas is a former chief economist at the President's Council of Economic Advisors and former director of the Congressional Budget Office. He's one of the country's foremost experts on tax policy. He's now president of the American Action Forum, an organization he founded in 2009 to provide data-driven insight to today's defining domestic policy challenges. Today's call is part of a tax reform series we'll be running through the summer, featuring a number of different experts and policymakers. It's also an opportunity for you to ask questions about current proposals and offer your advice as a business leader. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across the country. At these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives get the chance to brief policymakers on issues affecting their businesses and how Washington can work with business to accelerate our economy. To date, more than 550 senior administration officials, members of Congress, governors, and mayors have participated in our programming. This is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I need to cover a few housekeeping items. First, this call is on the record and reporters may be present. Second, a recording of this call will be sent to you once we're done. And finally, there'll be time for you to ask questions and share your advice. You can do this in one of two ways. You can press one at any time and you'll be put in queue to ask your question live, or you can email it to us at info@businessfwd.org. That's info@businessfwd.org. When you call, when we call on you to ask a live question, or when you send your email, please introduce yourself, the kind of business you have, and where you're calling from. Again, you can press 1 to ask your question live, or send your question to us by email at info@businessfwd.org. Let's get started. Please welcome Douglas Holtz-Eakin. Douglas, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for a chance to be on the call and everyone who's joined. The starting point for this conversation is the fact that the U.S. economy grew rapidly enough between the end of World War II and 2007 that even with the arrival of the large baby boom population, GDP per capita, a rough measure of income per person or the standard of living, doubled roughly every 35 years. And I've always thought that what that said is that in one working career, someone could pursue their version of the American dream, whatever that may be, buy a house, send a kid to college, something like that. Current projections are that with GDP growing at real terms at about 1.8 to 2% in population growth, the standard of living will double roughly every 75 years. And so the capacity to reach the American dream is getting further out toward the horizon. And this, I think, is the core reason why Donald Trump is the president of the United States and there are majorities of Republicans in the House and the Senate. They will be judged in the end on only one thing, and that is whether they have delivered better economic performance to the citizens of the U.S. A key part of the potential for better performance is tax reform. I think most people would agree that doing nothing is not an option. There's lots of evidence to suggest that the corporation income tax is the single most anti-growth tax a country can levy. The U.S. has a very high statutory rate, 35%, far above our developed country competitors. It clings to a worldwide system of taxation where a U.S. firm's global profits are all taxable in the U.S. That's produced a number of phenomena. Number one, if a U.S. firm and a German firm compete in Brazil, the German firm pays the Brazilian tax and is done. The U.S. firm is liable for the Brazilian tax and then a second layer of tax up to the 35% rate. So they're at an immediate disadvantage in global competition. Number two, the U.S. firm can temporarily ameliorate their problems by not bringing the money back to the U.S. And so keeping cash parked offshore dodges the second layer of tax, but it also means that increasingly we are locating investments and economic activity outside the U.S., not in the U.S. And then number three, and most troubling to many people, is the fact that in the course of any cross-border merger or acquisition, if you run the numbers, If the headquarters are in the U.S., the combined earnings of the new firm will be taxed globally at the 35% rate. If you locate the headquarters outside of the U.S., then you will pay a lower rate and only taxes on a territory-by-territory basis. It is inevitable that the U.S. will lose the headquarters, and increasingly we are losing all of our major headquartered corporations. A little-known fact to many Americans is that the New York Stock Exchange, the iconic symbol of American capitalism, is located in the Netherlands and for those tax purposes. And so I think there's a broad agreement that something has to happen. And at that point, we get to the current debate, which has a threshold question, which is, do we want to simply have tax cuts, as the president proposed on the campaign, cutting the corporate rate to 15%, but clinging to a worldwide system, or do we want to have a tax reform, something which is fundamentally different in our approach to business taxation and would provide incentives for innovation, investment, growth in the United States? And I think this is probably the most important question that the White House and the Congress need to sort out and sort out very, very fast. To my eye, the most powerful tax reforms will be those which are permanent, those which contain structural changes, such as moving from a worldwide to a territorial-like system, and as a result, transform the incentives that businesses face from the tax code. If you do tax reform in so-called reconciliation, these special procedures that allow you to get through the Senate with a mere 51-vote majority instead of a 60-vote supermajority, you cannot create long-term deficits. What that means from a practical point of view is if you do, say, House-style tax reform, it has to be revenue neutral, and at the end of the 10-year budget window, things have to balance back up and not have a larger deficit. Then the law can pass and stay on the books forever. If that's not true, it will lose its protected status and require a 60-vote majority. The way that's been dealt with historically is you sunset whatever you have proposed that's creating the deficit. So we saw the Bush tax cuts sunset after 10 years for exactly that reason. The calculations that people have done up in Congress are that if you were to cut the corporate rate, you could cut it for 1 year or 2 years, but you could not cut it for 3 years because if you sunset it after 3 years, you still have a deficit in year 11. You've thus violated the rules of Senate reconciliation, and all you can get is a two-year rate cut on a temporary basis. And so from a Senate procedures point of view, revenue-neutral reform has the chance to be permanent. Almost anything that's not revenue-neutral and looks like a tax cut is going to sunset and maybe sunset very quickly, and there'll be a real question about the bang you get for that kind of an economic policy. I also think it's worth recognizing that, you know, outside of Senate considerations, it's hard to do tax reform. It may be even harder to keep tax reform, and the lesson of 1986, in my view, is shortly after the 86 reform, we started to run what seemed at the time like large federal deficits, $100 billion, $150 billion. There became pressure for more revenue. Very quickly, the code got opened up and the tax reform unwound. So it's unwise to create deficits in the course of tax reform just as a matter of doing business because you're sowing the seeds for the destruction of the integrity of the tax reform in the very process of doing it. So I think threshold decision to get settled is, are they going to be settling for temporary tax cuts of some type, or are they going to do tax reform and have it be permanent? And if they go down the latter path, what will that look like? At this point, the administration has migrated to its budget proposals, which argue, without details, that they'll do revenue-neutral reform, and their last one-pager that came out with Mnuchin and Cohn indicated they had moved to a territorial system. So they have fairly steadily migrated away from the campaign proposals of large tax cuts that didn't change the structure very much. They're now at revenue-neutral reform. They're talking about some structural changes. But to date, the only thing that looks like a plan and is far from fully fleshed out remains the House blueprints. The House blueprints would move the rate from 35% down to 20%. It would change the tax base to a business cash flow tax, and in that way it is the single most dramatic proposed change in business taxation ever in the U.S. The tax base would be sales minus your expenses, including the full cost up front of all tangible and intangible capital investments, so full expensing of tangible and intangible investment. It would have employee compensation be deductible. There's a not well-specified research and development credit or bonus deduction to allow incentives there. And notably, you will not be allowed to deduct the net interest cost of your debt financing. So debt and equity finance investments will be treated the same. The virtues of this from a tax policy point of view are that it treats on a level playing field tangible and intangible capital. It treats on a level playing field short-lived and long-lived investments. So I'll get fully expensed up front. It treats on a level playing field debt and equity finance investments. And it leaves to capital markets the job of allocating capital to the most productive use. The expensing is a powerful investment incentive. The neutrality results get you better, efficient use of capital. The goal is to generate more investment, greater productivity, greater innovation. And the last feature, which has gotten a lot more attention, is the notion that this tax would be border adjusted. It would be applied to imports into the U.S., and U.S. exports would be exempted. That would make it a tax system that is neutral with respect to production decisions. If you produce outside the U.S., you pay the same taxes if you produce in the U.S. What matters is that you're selling it in the U.S. That would, on the whole, move the system from a tax system that favors foreign production over domestic production to one that's neutral. That's not a neutral change. That's a shift toward domestic production. And cementing a U.S. tax system with a single layer of tax, just one tax, not a corporate tax and a value-added tax, at a low rate of 20%, with incentives to invest and innovate in the U.S., has been the objective of the designers of that tax from the beginning. Let me just close with a couple other notes on the border adjustment, and then be happy to answer questions. In the context of the House blueprint, the way the border adjustment works is has nothing to do with the border. When someone sits down to do their firm's taxes, they would simply discard all cross-border transactions. So if you have revenue from exports into Germany, you would exclude that revenue and it would thus be implicitly not taxed. If you have costs on imports from Indonesia, you would discard that transaction. It wouldn't be deducted, and thus implicitly those costs would be taxed, those imports would be taxed. The main feature that this brings to the blueprint is one that protects the integrity of the tax base. Because it's a territorial system, you need something to prevent a firm from using transfer prices to locate their profits in, say, Ireland and then repatriate the profits, the after-tax profits back to the U.S. The way you usually do that is sell your IP, say, to Ireland for a dollar and then buy back finished goods at a very high price, locate a bunch of profits in Ireland, they pay a low Irish tax or some other tax haven, bring it to the U.S. Because you're discarding cross-border transactions, how you value them, the $1 sale of IP or the expensive import, doesn't change your domestic liability. All you do if you undertake that transaction is raise your Irish tax liability. Your U.S. liability is the same. That's raising your global taxes. That's not in a firm's interest to do. And so the main feature of the border adjustment is to remove the incentives for profit shifting and base erosion in the U.S. It would be easier to comply and audit with because it's in the firm's interest to do it. The only transactions that matter are those between domestic suppliers and domestic customers. Those are much more easily monitored by the tax authority. It's a world away from other approaches. The reason I mention that is there's been a lot of sort of controversy, obviously, about the border adjustment, but it's not a choice about whether you have border adjustment or not. The choice is, do you have a tax reform with, say, border adjustment, or do you have a tax reform that goes to a territorial system with some other approach to controlling base erosion and profit shifting? And those other approaches, say Dave Camp base erosion rules or income taxes, are comparably contentious, have comparably differential impacts on the business community, and will be just as contentious, I think, in the drafting. That's the nature of tax reform. The advantage to the border adjustment that people have keep pointing out is it helps raise revenue, which allows you to get the rate down to 20%. Without it, you're probably at 28%. So, the basic state of play is, A, we need tax reform. B, anything that's not revenue neutral is not going to be permanent, and you have to decide whether you're going to be satisfied with something that sunsets. And then C, if it's not going to be the house sort of blueprint and that approach, what alternatives can be put together quickly that have comparable economic and incentive effects and which can get through the House and the Senate? So why don't I stop there? There's obviously a lot of territory here. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. You broke up for a moment when you were talking about the two alternatives to the BAT. Could you explain what those were? I'm sorry?
I apologize.
So if you're not going to do border adjustment to do the base protection, then you could do something like Dave Camp's base erosion rules. He had a variety of options when he tried to do his tax reform plan. Those are the polar opposite of the border adjustment. They amount to having the tax authority go through every transaction, including those between foreign subs, between the foreign sub and the parent, plus the domestic transactions, and just basically saying, okay, this one's a legitimate business transaction. This is a tax abuse. This is a business transaction. And those are, you know, I think, comparably contentious. They, again, affect businesses differently, and businesses disagree. And then the third possibility is some sort of alternative minimum tax that really would have to be sort of specified much more carefully to see if it would really work in the context of the rest of the reform. So that's the menu, but you have to have something, or you're going to have a really big problem collecting any revenue.
Got it. Thank you. Now we'll open up to your questions and comments. If you have a question and you want to ask it live, just press 1 on your dial pad, and you'll go into our queue, or you can email your question to us at info@businessfwd.org. Our first question is from Susan Oler from Louisville, Kentucky, and she asks, how does tax reform fit with Obamacare repeal and the budget?
Good question. The leadership in the House has said continually that they want to get the health care bill, the American Health Care Act, finished so that they can turn to tax reform. They're not linked mechanically or budgetarily, but the politics are linked. The health care bill contains about $1 trillion in tax cuts coming from the repeal of the Affordable Care Act taxes, the medical device tax, the surtax on net investment income for high-income individuals, surtax on payrolls, health insurer's fee, Cadillac tax, a whole list of these ACA taxes. It's their judgment that if you were to not pass that bill, you would then start up tax reform, and in particular, the medical device coalition would insist that any piece of tax legislation that leaves the House would have to contain repeal of the medical device tax. There are a substantial number of Republicans on that. They could probably stop any legislation from going forward. So the device tax would have to go into tax reform. At that point, the door is open, and the issue becomes, well, if the device tax is in, why isn't the health insurer tax in? Why isn't the net investment tax in? Why isn't the Cadillac tax in? And pretty soon, you've added $1 trillion in additional cuts that you're going to have to get base broadeners to offset if you want to have a revenue-neutral reform. Their view is that's probably too big a lift and would endanger tax reform. So they'd like to get the health care bill out of the way, take care of those ACA-related taxes, which they basically view as A, bad policy, and B, not necessary with their style of health care reform, and then move to tax reform with the sort of effort not encumbered by those issues.
Got it. Thanks. Our next question is from Toby Malachi from Indianapolis, Indiana. Toby, you're live.
Thank you, Douglas. My name is Dr. Toby Malachi. I'm the founder and CEO of Malachi Group Worldwide here in Indianapolis, Indiana. Douglas, we are an SME, a small, medium-sized enterprise who operates in over 70 countries around the world. I'm also the vice chairman of the U.S. Foreign Commercial Service, U.S. Department of Commerce, Indiana District Export Council, and a former board member of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. My question is, if the current tax rate, 35%, has corporations asking for relief globally, I don't hear any talk or dialogue or narrative specific to SMEs, small, medium-sized enterprises, who a lot of times we just don't have the sophistication of a CFO or some of the tax breaks realized by corporations. I would like to hear your specific views coming from the Trump administration, if there are any, how to relate to SMEs. Why aren't we being talked about in these dialogues and narratives? And two, in terms of cost and profits, we do business around the world, and the double taxation kills us. So if we do a deal in Indianapolis, we do a medical device in a certain country, we get taxed double, and that's very cost prohibitive for SMEs for us to compete in a global marketplace where 96% of our customers are outside of the borders of the United States of America. So in terms of revenue neutrality, can you please give me specifics, tell us specifics as small, medium-sized enterprises, what benefits you see of this tax proposal, which is very hard to come by tax reform. And then secondly, I always say about SMEs, I'd rather us be at the table and be on the menu. Thank you very much.
Sure. First, just to make clear for everyone on the call, I don't speak for the Trump administration. I won't pretend to have particular inside knowledge of what the West Wing's thinking about. I'd say a couple of things. Number one, the double taxation is an issue, and one of the reasons the House went down this route is to make sure that by relieving the tax on exports, there is only the tax being levied in the country of sale, and there's a level tax playing field. Similarly, by imposing a tax on imports, you level the tax playing field. Everyone being sold in the U.S. is paying the 20% tax. Best product wins, and that's a foundation of competitive market economics. Second thing is, while it hasn't been framed in terms of the language of SMEs, there's been a concern about doing comprehensive tax reform, individual plus corporate, in large part because half of U.S. business income is now taxed on individual income tax returns as pass-through entities, whether they're LLPs or LLCs or proprietorships. That's the SME community to some extent, and they would have the same set of changes to the tax base that the business that the C-Corps got, which I just described. They would, for the first time, have a tax rate on the individual income tax that is separate for business income, 25%, as opposed to wage income and things like that, which would have a schedule of 33, 25, and down at 12. So they've separated the taxation of business income as an explicit recognition that you have to get taxes down on the SMEs as well. That's going to produce some tax compliance issues because people have an incentive to characterize their wage income as business income, but the folks evidently felt it was worth it in terms of providing competitiveness of those enterprises both globally and in the U.S.
Our next question is from Sheila Neely from Phoenix, Arizona, and she asks, could you explain more about the preference of debt over equity, and if we get this right, who benefits? Is this for investors or for the companies?
So the if you look at the business tax base that I described, it's essentially a large traditional IRA in disguise. You take and if you deduct, if you have any investment, you deduct it fully at the time you invest it, and then when it has a payoff and you get revenue, it gets taxed as it comes out. That's the same as sort of the deduction for contributions to an IRA, and then you pay on whatever you take out at your tax rate. As with those IRA-like vehicles, this tax base would exempt from tax entirely the normal rate of return to capital. So at the business level, this does not tax the normal rate of return. It taxes only those who earn above normal rates of return and get a liability. The drafters felt that zero on the normal rate of return to capital was enough, and that providing an additional tax benefit for those who borrowed to make those investments would actually drive them to negative rates of return, and that seemed undesirable. So they've set it this way to get the zero on both debt and equity financed, and that's the logic behind it. As an aside, over on the individual side of the House proposal, half of the dividends, interest, and capital gains would be exempt from tax, and so there would be some return tax on the return to capital on individual tax rates, but the business side doesn't have any. Clearly, this is something that you can't go to overnight. There are existing financing structures which where the economics were built on the leverage, and there will have to be a set of transition rules embedded in any legislation unveiled on this plan if they go that way. And how they do that will matter, obviously. I would say that this is a clear winner for people who are investing a lot and have very efficient capital investment plans. It is a clear detriment to anyone who has a tax-based, tax-preferred return as a key part of their business model. So you're getting rid of that tax preference, and those who are relying on it are going to see that they have to change.
Our next question is from Michael Kelly in Los Angeles. Michael, you're live.
Sure. Thank you, everybody, for all this information and bringing everybody together. I head up a coalition of a lot of principal CEOs and presidents and heads of universities out here in the Los Angeles region, and always with our eyes on the economy and creating quality jobs. And the thing that we're fearful of is, if you look at the proposals from the Republican leadership in the White House about the elimination of federal deductibility of state and local taxes, and not just on California, but if you look at, I think this would impact states that represent about 47% of our overall GDP. What, is this a lot more politically driven, or is it actually reality that they are going to do something about this year?
It's been in all the plans that I've seen. One can never tell how much politics and how much economic policy is in play. I won't pretend otherwise. The economic policy argument is that you should not essentially provide an implicit subsidy to a larger state-level government by providing the deductibility, that if people face the full cost of the taxes they pay to the state and they know the benefits they receive from their state programs, they'll get the state government right-sized, and the federal government shouldn't be altering the calculus that goes on there. That's the logic behind getting rid of the deduction. Again, this strikes me as something they may have transition rules on, but certainly it's been in everything I've seen so far.
Our next question is from Chris Tipton from San Francisco, California. Could you explain what the savings would be for immediate expensing, and what are there any projections about the increase in capital investment that it would create?
So immediate expensing is actually, from a budget point of view, not a saving. It's a very expensive tax preference. But because you expense up front, but you don't get future deductions as you would with the depreciation schedule, in the out years, it actually starts to gain revenue. And it's one of the reasons a House-style plan can get through the Senate reconciliation process, because the out year generates more revenue because of the expensing provision, and if you phase in the net interest deductibility getting eliminated, you get more revenue in the out years, and so that's part of the mechanics of how this kind of a reform fits into the budget process. If you look at the literature on House-style reforms, which contain expensing as the key investment incentive, the literature basically would suggest that at the upper bound, if you were quite disciplined and didn't load up the tax reform with a lot of other nuts and bolts that don't do anything, you could get about a half a percentage point of growth out of it over the next 10 years. And so we're say at 2, that could get you to 2.5. If you wanted to get to the 3 that the administration has put in its budget and specifies its goal, you're going to have to then turn to the other pieces of policymaking at your disposal, whether it's your trade policies, your regulatory policies, what you're going to do with worker training, education skills, other sources of productivity growth. So expensing is pretty important in the plan. It's at the heart of how you get people to choose to invest and to make it equal between whether they
do intangible investments in ideas and business model things, or tangible capital factory and equipment kinds of investments.
Our next question is from Kathleen Mistry from Great Falls, Virginia. Kathleen, you're live.
Thank you. I own an advisory services firm, and I'm also on the board of directors for an expat club in Europe. And when we advocate on the Hill, we're very concerned about the various taxation and banking issues that are inhibiting the expats from getting senior executive positions overseas. Can the speaker speak to that for a minute, please?
So if I understand the question, it's about the U.S. tax treatment of income earned overseas. And
it is that placement. They don't want to hire us overseas when we're going to be being put on the books somewhere, and then that is opening up that foreign company to being audited by the U.S. government.
Right. So the House-style proposed reform is a move to a territorial system, and so your income earned outside the U.S. would not be subject to tax, and as a result would not be subject to audit for U.S. tax, and it would change that dramatically.
So, Douglas, we have a number of people who are expats who participate in Business Forward, and this comes up. That issue actually comes up quite a bit, and we've heard from a number of people that this is essentially the Australia and Irish jobs program problem, that a lot of American companies are hiring Australians and Irish citizens or Americans just because of the cost difference. Our next question is from
this is a good place to sort of make a point about the differences in the compliance, the ways you do compliance. You could still go to a territorial system, but if the way you enforce the base erosion is to have these rules where you look at all transactions, including those between foreign subsidiaries and from parents to subs, you may still fall into the audit net, even though that income is not subject to tax. And that's probably the worst of all worlds, is to have the audit and compliance burden without any tax revenue received.
Our next question is from Jay Steinmetz, CEO of Barcoding, Inc. in Baltimore, Maryland. Question is, isn't this tax rate going to incentivize people to leave employment and become self-employed in order to see a reduced rate of taxation of 15%? I'm worried that people will set up LLC and S-Corps for the purpose of saving on taxes, similar to what happened in Kansas.
It's a legitimate concern. The president talked about moving the business tax on pass-through entities to 15%, the House is at 25%. In both cases, it's well below the top individual marginal rate, and you have a tax-based incentive to characterize your income as business income. We've seen this in reverse. After the 86 Act, we saw an explosion of pass-through entities for tax-based reasons. And I think most people who look at either the House or the President's proposals worry about this a lot. The Kansas thing was quite striking. They got it exactly wrong because they put the rate at zero. This is at least not at zero, but there's still an incentive to do it. And you'll probably either have to give up on this and tax it at ordinary income rates, that's been one strategy, or write some rules on sort of characterizing income characterization rules, which we have already. We could just sort of port them over into the new system where certain fractions of your business income are implicitly your salary and will be taxed at your individual rates.
Douglas, I know you're here speaking as a policy expert, but in terms of the politics, when do you see the House, Senate, and White House beginning to come together to try to come up with a joint plan?
So I'm, I'll lay my cards on the table. I have no reason to be cute about this. I believe tax reform is very important and desperately needed, and I am very concerned that we're behind the curve already. And that they need to get moving in order to get this done. And this is a longer answer than you deserve, but here's how I think about it. If you look at the Tax Reform Act of 1986, it began in the mid-70s with people on the left, Dick Gephardt, Bill Bradley, people on the right, Art Laffer, Alvin Roth, Jack Kemp, talking about how bad the tax system was, how it was hurting Americans and needed to be fixed. A sitting president ran for re-election promising to do tax reform, Ronald Reagan. He won 49 states, which is pretty good. and then wrote a tax reform and sent it to Capitol Hill saying this is what the people elected me to deliver, and it died twice on the way to finally getting done after a long time. And so with all those political tailwinds, it was very hard to get done. I don't think we're anywhere near a comparable situation. I don't think we've had the same public education. It's not been as bipartisan. It's certainly not going to be bipartisan. This is going to be a Republican-only set of votes, and I think it's all much harder. And so I would encourage them to get going as fast as possible. And I certainly don't think, as a matter of the politics, there is any way for this to get over the finish line without the President of the United States saying, quite forcefully, this is what I was sent to deliver to the American people. This is what is going to help this economy perform better. We need to get this done. Because you really need White House leading the charge on this kind of thing. So I am worried about the state of play. They haven't yet produced any real draft legislation anywhere. There's one blueprint in the House. There's nothing in the Senate. The White House has not seemingly come down forcefully in favor of any single thing. And I think the time is getting near where they really do have to make a decision like that and get going.
Well, Douglas, thank you very much for joining us. This is the first in a series of calls and webinars we'll be doing. Before we close off, just a few quick announcements. Join us next month for our conference call on tax reform with Mark Mazur, former Assistant Treasury Secretary for Tax Policy in the Obama Treasury Department. Next week, please join us for a conference call on foreign direct investment with Fred Volkanith of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And also, please check your email for recording of today's call and a quick survey. We're always trying to improve the quality of our programming, and we greatly appreciate your feedback. Thank you, Douglas, for joining us, and thank you, everyone, for joining today's call. We look forward to working with you again on tax reform in the coming months. Have a great day.